Thanks for giving me this chance to speak to you. I have been looking at the dynamics and the elastic properties of bacterial flagella for a couple of years. And the more I learn about it, the more amazing the subject seems to be. These structures that have evolved to propel the bacteria around. And in fact, when I give a talk to undergraduates, I call this Secrets of Alien Technology Revealed, because in a sense, this doesn't show anything about bacterial flagella. It's just a nice picture. But these flagella are so amazing. They're like little engineered machines, and I'm sure everyone who's looked in biological physics knows what I'm talking about. So I'm going to give a little diversive introduction. Some of the general issues: how do bacteria swim, is a legitimate question. Here is the scale of a Salmonella cell, for instance. It's about a micron or so in length, and maybe half of that in breadth. And the flagella, when it's swimming, when it's doing what's called the run behavior, extend behind the cell, and typically 10 times as long as the cell body itself. We know from the work of Berg and other people that bacteria swim by a concatenation of runs and tumbles. Runs are basically straight line motions, linear motions, and then there is a tumbling event, you could call it, in which the bacteria kind of move axially and change their orientation. Then they pick, seemingly at random, a new direction and do a run and then another tumble. So it goes run, tumble, like that.
Yeah, are the tumbles rotational diffusion, or is it more axis?
The statistics have been done, and it shows it's diffusive. But do you mean the actual mechanics
Yeah.
of the tumble? That's complicated.
For instance, the time
That's
scale
actually
for
pretty
exploring
complicated.
Because
Yeah.
I mean, as you probably will get to, I mean, the tumbling is important for its
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was wondering.
Multi-micron.
That's right.
Things is
so
tenth of a second or something like that, which is much
Yeah, it's
faster.
of order a
I
tenth
always
of a
wondered
second.
what's the rotational
I
always wondered how it could be rotational diffusion.
Okay, so.
No, it's not. Statistically, I thought you were speaking statistically. It's kind of Poissonian, but I should say the statistics of the runs. It's not rotational diffusion. There's a very complicated flagellar dynamics going on during a tumble, and I'll say a little bit about that. Though this talk won't be about the some of those complications. So that's at the very coarsest level. At a fine scale, we should like to understand it in terms of the properties of the filaments and the motors and the fluid, which should be described by Stokes' equations. I won't go into detail, many experts in the audience, but we know that the Stokes' equations have very nice properties. For instance, we could take the divergence of each side of this equation here, and we would have basically, because of the divergence-free condition, we would get a harmonic equation for the pressure, assuming that the force here was also divergence-free. There's many nice properties. One of the neat things was pointed out by Purcell in the late 70s and had to do with the requirements for propulsion and his famous scallop theorem. So this, you could think of, limits the type of propulsive behaviors at low Reynolds number. So I'll just go through it very briefly to give you a flavor of it. Imagine we had a bivalve scallop, and let's say, for the sake of argument, that it was moving from right to left. So it's doing a completely symmetric opening and closing of its linear shells here. Well, because there's no time explicit in this equation, I could take t to negative t and get another solution to these equations, as long as I was careful of reversing things on boundaries. And that would give me a scallop doing exactly the same motion, but going from left to right. So clearly, I can't have both solutions at the same time. So the conclusion is that there can't be any net motion of a scallop which is doing this simple motion. So that wouldn't lead to a net propulsion. And you can make, yes. So you might ask, how do bacteria get around this kind of this requirement? Well, they rotate an object which is chiral. And I have an example, some helices here. This is actually a right-handed helix. And in the run state, the flagellum of the bacterium is left-handed. But you get the idea. If you were rotate this, let's say, counterclockwise, or let's say clockwise, from looking down toward the cell body, then when I make a movie going backwards of that state, I'd have the same handedness of the helix, but going in the opposite direction. So then to get back to the original state, which is how these tricky arguments work, I'd have to take a mirror image of the whole situation. But in doing so, then I'd reverse the direction of the motion again. So having a chiral object is just enough complication to put a monkey wrench in that theorem, if you like. I mean, the theorem is still valid, but you can't get stringent bounds on the propulsion that way. I mean, you can't make a same kind of conclusion. You can for other systems. For instance, there's an argument by there's a paper by Taylor, an old paper, which excited a lot of interest in studying propulsion at low Reynolds number, also at high Reynolds number. And he considered flagella, but the eukaryotic kind, which I'll say more about in a second, as basically sheets that were moving. And he looked at various things concerning these sheets, about their synchrony. But you could apply the same argument to his system. You could say, what if I had two neighboring flagella, and what was happening was that I had a right-moving sine waves on those flagella. I can use the same kind of Stokesian time symmetry argument. I could time reverse. Well, before I say that, let's make a supposition, which I wrote over here. Suppose they move in sync with each other and closer together. What I'm really after is figuring out, say, what the pressure is doing in this solution, so I could figure out if they move closer, if they move further apart during this motion. So let's suppose that they move closer together. Well, all I have to do is time reverse that situation. Then I'd get left-moving waves moving farther apart. But I could then take that and just rotate it by 180 degrees. And then I'd get right-moving waves still moving farther apart. That contradicts my supposition that I had right-moving waves moving closer together. So here I have a neutrally stable situation. The net motion can't be toward or away from each other for these. That's just another example. I'm not actually going to look at that system. OK, this will just be kind of a fun slide to show you the scale of things. I stole these pictures from David Goodsell's book, The Machinery of Life. So these are common. Well, I guess I should start down here. These are common things that are more or less our size, an amoeba, human hair, salt crystal, and so on. Then what he does is expand this little thing 10 times. And that's what's up here. And there you see a eukaryotic sperm with its flagella. So this is a little bit of the confusion in the terminology. The tail of a eukaryotic cell is also called a flagellum, same as a bacterial cell, even though the scales are quite different. Bacterial cells are like these E. coli up here. And you can compare them in size. They're smaller than a red blood cell for a human. And now what I'll do is I'll expand that, the edge of that bacterium there, 100 times. And I get this little blue box over here. These are the flagella that I'm talking about. So you see the scale, as compared to the eukaryotic cells, quite different. There's a virus sitting up there and so on. The diameter here is about 20 nanometers, which you could figure out if you knew this was about half a micron or so. If you look at the cross section, a lot is known about that from crystallographic studies, which are quite carefully done. This is not a cross section per se. It's kind of a projected density, electron density contour. What you see is an 11-fold structure. So you can interpret the flagellum as being composed of 11 threads. These are sometimes called protofilaments. And these 11 threads wind slightly around the cylinder that defines the filament. So there's a helical structure there, you might say. But on a larger scale, on the scale of microns, you see this. You see the corkscrew shape I referred to before. Again, this is adapted from work done by DeRozier at Brandeis.
So you have shown two ways to...
If you consider this as a columnar crystal, then you could unfold it in the plane, and you could make different paths, different kinds of threads along that. So I just do that in two different ways here. Calladine, in the 1970s, actually suggested this 11-fold structure, and it was later verified. But here, my main goal is to give you a sense of scale, 18 nanometers in diameter, and the scale of these flagellum. Flagellum is the protein making up the flagellum. It's about tens of angstroms.
How clearly defined are these so-called protofilaments? You say unfolded, right? A similar system is magnitudinal, which has comparable dimensions.
Yeah.
And there you seem to have much better defined real filaments.
Yeah.
Making it up. Should one really not think of anything but a curved sort of two-dimensional array here, or?
It's a very good question. I'm sort of in the camp of believing in the reality of the protofilaments.
Any pictures like where they fray or something at the end?
No. Again, the best things you'll ever see, at least I've seen, are like this. Even though I traced that from a.
Even in the case of Magnitubius, you know, the filament duplicate, you know,
Yeah.
Yes. With DNA, they have way to look at DNA denaturation. They have this absorption of light. Can you do something similar for this to see whether it opens up?
I'm not sure. I think it would be very hard. You're referring to crystallographic or single molecule studies?
To detect the maturation of DNA.
Yes.
As much as temperature, they have absorption of
200. Okay. I don't know, actually. That would be interesting to go back to your comment about decomposing it into protofilaments, if that's possible. I don't know of anything like that, and my guess is it's you can't do that. But I don't have an argument one way or the other. Just as a contrast, I'll show you the eukaryotic cross section, at least my version of it. The diameter in the case, this is like a sperm tail. 10 times bigger, so you could say the cross section is 100 times the area, roughly. As Fred pointed out, the microtubules there, you could say, are somewhat comparable to the entire flagellum in the case. This is the famous 9 plus 2 structure of the eukaryotic flagellum. 9 microtubule, the actual microtubule bundles on the periphery and 2 in the center. And they're not, they're somewhat carefully engineered microtubule bundles too. They're not your garden variety ones. These are also the structure of cilia. But they don't call the sperm tail cilia, even though it's similar structure. Oh, in the center? Yeah. Yes.
So
yeah.
Is the structure stable?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know so much about this system. I have to say there's a lot of scaffolding internal to this. There's these dynein arms, for instance, that are linking the 9 around here, and then presumably this what I wrote spokes in the center, and there's structural elements here too, I assume.
What I meant was that it's not a problem, it's like a diamond or something with things on the spokes.
Oh, these?
Yeah.
They're diamonds, but
yes, that's right. They're not too complete. That's why I draw one as a C and the other as an O. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's not your garden variety microtubule bundle there.
Are dynein arms arranged in any way reminiscent of the myosin? Because they're motors.
Yeah.
Are they also bundled?
I don't know.
Superficially, there might be an analogy with the two bundles moving relative to each other in muscles.
As far as I read in these books, it's similar, but you have also places where things cannot move. That's why it's in battle. You try to move things like that. You try, but you cannot, so you battle.
Unlike the bacterial flagellum, this isn't driven by a motor at one end.
Right, the motor's all the way along.
The motor's all the way along, as you say. And so it's generating torques along every section of it. So I don't know how the dynein arms are arranged. I'm going to go back to the bacterial flagellum now. the motor. The bacterial flagellum is like this columnar crystal. It's driven at one end by a motor which is embedded in the cell membranes. Here's a schematic of it, but here is this ghostly image that de Rozier produced in his lab. This is actually a compilation of electron micrographs, which have been carefully filtered, you could say, for noise. But I think everything he does is quite legitimate there, in fact. And you can see the resolution here is extremely good. This little bar here is 50 angstroms, and he's getting resolution well below that. And what's amazing here, you can see the central shaft coming through the motor. You can see these rings, structures which look like bushings and stators, and it looks like a piece of Victorian technology more than anything else.
So how would the membrane be in that radio image, ghostly image?
Oh, okay. It's not there, of course, but where would it be? You can make a correspondence with this schematic down here. These rings correspond to these rings here, the L and the P, or the L and the P here. And then this, the lowest leaf of the membrane, you could say, is down here, where this is kind of an anchoring arrangement.
More than just a single bilayer, they have like...
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what these are supposed to be, lipids and other kinds of membranes. PG, peptidoglycan, I think.
That's actually a rigid structure.
That's right. That's right. That's like a coat.
Yeah.
That's right. So that would come at the P ring, which is right here. what's generating the torque here isn't even imaged in this. Whatever he does to prepare these, he separates these from the cell body chemically and then suspends them in ice, and all these are cuts through ice. It gets rid of the things that's actually producing the torque. And those would presumably sit on the periphery of this ring here, but they're not, we don't know what they are exactly. And I mean, there's other studies which have revealed some details about those. But so the motor mechanism isn't understood for these at all, I would say. I won't go into the details about how that image was produced unless people are interested later. I'd like to now go back to some old work about the flagellum itself. Forget the motor. Just consider the flagellum as an elastic object. This is a study done with dark field microscopy by Asakura many years ago. And what Asakura did, even though you can't resolve the diameter of these objects, they're only 20 nanometers across, can't resolve them with visible light, you can scatter light off of them. And you can see the pitch. The pitch is of order microns of these objects. So that's how we can see, for instance, these dark field images. What Asakura did here was something very simple. He had a flagellum sitting near the surface of the glass slide, and he just changed the plane of focus. And so if the plane of focus is near the top, you see the turns of the helix, or the filament, going one way. When the plane of focus is right in the middle of the filament, it's symmetric. And then when the plane of focus is near the glass slide, it goes the other way. So just imagine, here's my flagellum. And you can see the parts going in and out of focus on the glass. Here, that's exactly the same phenomenon. If I cut the flagellum at the top, you see the turns going one way. In the middle, it's symmetric. And near the bottom, it goes the other way. This is just evidence that these things really are very accurately helices.
So just by that, sorry.
Yes.
Just by that set of images, can you actually really determine if it's right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. So I'm looking down, let's say, on this object. You can see it's left-handed just by using your left hand. You can see the ones that are in focus are the ones that are nearest to you and farthest from the glass slide. And here, you're right in the middle, it's symmetric. And now the ones that are in focus are the ones sitting on the glass slide. So it's just like, imagine trying to find the handedness of this helix just from seeing which is blurry and which is in focus.
That's like a three,
it's hard the first time, but once you once you do it once, you got it, right?
What's the diameter of the envelope in that helix? The overall diameter?
Fractions of a micron, about a fifth of a micron, something like that, 0.2. That's the cylindrical. So imagine putting the helix on the surface of a cylinder. So the diameter, I should say, 0.4, something like that, microns. Yes?
And yet it's resolved?
It's not resolved. This is not the accurate diameter, what you're seeing there.
You're saying that the apparent diameter of the whole cylinder is only a half micron?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Can you even see that much detail?
Well, unless I'm horribly wrong, but I think that's right.
Okay.
Now, I'll just show you.
I'm
going to show you a movie now, if it works. Okay, so these are. These are movies made by McNabb, who's at Yale, back in the late 70s, I believe. I only show this, this shows a flow. Actually, the microscope is not moving, the bacteria are flowing past, but you can see ones that are swimming against the flow. Okay, so now what, they turn up the xenon lamp 100 times, what you saw there. And so this is that same illumination, and now they're going to turn it up to show you the flagella. So you see, there's a bundle. That's actually 10 or so flagella bundled together. So you have to remember, each of these flagella is only 20 nanometers in diameter, the bundle somewhat thicker. Swimming, okay, so this is tracking one. Bird perfected the technique of tracking these while they're moving. And now you'll see one doing a tumble. Okay, see the flagella. Those are individual flagella. So it's much more complicated thing going on during tumbling. But that wasn't an actual tumble. I think that was a mutant, which could only tumble, because the tumble doesn't last that long. All right. Okay. And I have another film, but I'm going to wait a second to show you that one. All right, now I'm getting closer to my topic. Hotani, about 25 years ago, 26 years ago, did an interesting thing. He detached the flagella from Salmonella, broke them up into the constituent flagellin subunits, mixed them together, and then reconstituted the flagella. And he saw things like this. Here is this one. Here's a single filament. And using the same technique that Asakura did to determine the handedness, you can do the same thing with this. If you do that, you'll see this is actually left-handed, just by looking at what's in focus and what's out of focus on the turns. And this is actually right-handed. So the filaments, in some cases, in many cases, I should say, reconstituted themselves in a form that looked like a concatenation of two helical segments. One which was right-handed and which had a different pitch and a different helical diameter.
Is there a kink at every joint?
Yeah, there's a kink. And the funny thing about the kink, it seems to always have the same angle. So Hotani measured that very accurately. And he got a lot of statistics on this. So this, there's a kink there. Here's the same, if you will, kink over here. And I just want to point out, that this is the state that's observed during the swimming. It's called normal by the people who do this. This is called curly. They have names for all the different states of the flagella. Normal and curly have this particular junction.
So that angle, naively, it has to be fixed, right? If you think of the helical, the right-handed helix and the left-handed helix,
yes.
Each have their own fixed pitch. They don't have to be the same.
That's right. The pitch is different. The helical diameter is different. This might be one. This might be the other, for instance.
The angle has to be fixed.
And the angle is fixed. And I'll get to that in a second. So Hotani called this the block angle. And I'm going to talk about that angle. And he measured it, found a very tight, it wasn't spread, peaked around 113 degrees for the curly to normal transition, and it was, the other examples of bistability. So there's an example of these two helices concatenated, or a transition between one helical state and another. So I'm going to get other bistable experiments that have been done on the flagellar system. McNabb and Berg, in separate studies, had observed that the tumbling itself is connected with this flip between right-handed and left-handed states of individual helices. And they saw this while they tracked moving bacteria. So this is a study which didn't involve separating the flagella from the cell body, but actually looking at live cells in different states. Sometimes they could attach a cell to the glass slide. Sometimes they attach the flagellum to the glass slide, and so on. And sometimes they just track it. But what I'm indicating here is that upon motor reversal, so the bacterial motor never stops. It goes either clockwise or counterclockwise. But upon the reversal of a motor, a wave, you could say, of flipped state of the helix moves down the length of the flagellum and changes the entire flagellum to the opposite handedness.
Actually, what are the statistics of the stepping of the rotation of the
people? People have, yeah.
Like, what's the probability of skipping and what's the time?
It's a broad subject because it depends on whether they're swimming natively. There's smooth swimming, which is another class. So it's a subject in its own right, but I can't give a simple answer to it, unfortunately.
Switching times are exponentially distributed, but with the time constant.
Well, Poisson, you mean Poisson distributed?
Sorry, the random events, but with time constant, that depends on how happy it is. So it's not a truly random thing, but it's doing some sampling of some decision process about how rapidly one can switch.
There are smooth swimming types, which always seem to be happy, you could say. And then the statistics for those are different. So,
whether it's swimming up gradients or down gradients or in the wrong direction or in the right direction.
Right. Maybe I should step back and say that the mechanism of the chemotaxis is the outlines of that are understood. That is, when the bacterium is swimming in a gradient that it likes, the frequency of tumbling is less. The frequency of tumbling is less when it's swimming in a gradient it likes. It measures gradients of order its cell body, right?
I would assume that when it likes, where it is, it will tumble more, so it stays there. When it doesn't like.
Oh no. It doesn't. It measures gradients. So it measures if it's going towards something it likes, and then it doesn't want to tumble, because a tumble basically effectively means random orientation. And so then it heads off in a new direction. It would be going away from what it likes, most probably. So
the periodic traveling domain, you don't really mean that mathematically. So you basically just intermittent left-hand and right-hand waves.
I don't mean quite intermittent. It's not exactly periodic, but episodic is maybe. I do mean something more or less periodic. Maybe not exactly periodic, but this comes to my second thing, and I should get to that. Hotani, the same guy who did these static experiments where he reconstituted the flagella, also looked at an isolated flagellum in an external flow. And what he did is he pinned one end to a glass slide and set a known flow rate past these, and observed patches of opposite handedness nucleating at the attached end, getting bigger, then detaching. By detaching, I mean the other handedness nucleated. And so now you have a patch of, say, right-handed in a filament which is overall left-handed. That patch then moves down the length of the flagellum and finally off the flagellum, and then you have another nucleation. So in that sense, it's periodic. Whether there's a well-defined period is something that you can explore. Yeah?
So when the bacterium is moving, you have the motor going in one direction. You can't swim right.
Yes.
When there's the stone, it's it reverse direction or just makes some sort of chaotic movement back and forth?
Okay, so the it's believed. This isn't well understood. So the sequence of events that lead from run to tumble mechanically isn't understood. But what's believed is that some subset of the motors change their direction. Not randomly, but if it's going counterclockwise, it'll go clockwise. That will initiate a very complicated sequence of events in the flagellum which is attached to that motor. Those flagella were initially bundled. The states of the flagellum will now affect that entire the coherence of that bundle. That bundle will eventually fray or come apart, and then you'll get tumbling. At the end of tumbling, these things have to come back together, and then it heads off in a new direction.
And this is connected to change of direction in chirality.
Yes, yeah, that's for sure. But exactly, the exact sequence of what happens, is it one motor? Is it three motors or something? That isn't understood.
One last question.
Yeah.
So if the motor is stopped, if you could stop it, would the molecule or the filament still be chiral?
Yes.
Would just
yes. And yeah, all those images I showed were without motors, without cells even. That was just the filament all by itself, and you saw it was a helix just by changing the focus in those dark field images. Here's another example. Here is, again, dark field images reversed, white to black, but this is a time sequence from a movie that Hotani made, and the frames are oriented so that time goes upward here. And I've just underlined in orange, or it looks like red here, I've underlined the states of the curly state. The rest of the filament is in what's called normal, left-handed, but then you can see here it's flipped to the right-handed state. That state then moves down the length of the flagellum and then off the flagellum. So that's that particular one nucleated down here. So here's the time sequence. Nucleates, grows, detaches, goes off the edge, and so on, and it repeats itself. That's from his movie, and the scale is shown there. The flow was about 7 microns per second.
The long tail is a fast-paced structure. You see that, like when the segment gets short, it actually buckles. But when
up here.
The long is not able to do that. Yeah.
That's right.
You see that? The
yeah.
It's already frustration there.
Well, yeah, frustration you mean in terms of that angle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the flow.
The flow is straightening things out. If I didn't have the flow, I'd see that angle even down here. I'll have a little more to say about that. All right, now I'm going to make contact with Chris Wiggins' talk last week. You could think of this as a general phenomenon. What's the elastic properties of filaments which not only want to be left-handed, but also under certain circumstances want to be right-handed helices. And that's not restricted to bacterial flagella. You could see that in other systems as well, perhaps. And so here's an example. This is a electron micrograph taken from the work of Tilby, who studied these Bacillus subtilis Chris mentioned at the end of his talk. These are bacteria which, when they reproduce, don't divide. They don't separate. So they just get longer and longer and longer. And even though it's a little hard to see because of the three-dimensional perspective, here's one-handed helix concatenated, and then there's an angle here to another direction. And the scale of that, of course, is much different than the flagellum. The diameter of each one of these is the same as the diameter of a Bacillus subtilis, which is of order a micron, 0.7 microns, something like that. Another example, though I'm not sure how seriously I should take this, is DNA. You know, DNA, the normal B-DNA is right-handed. Z-DNA is left-handed. And of course, we know we can have concatenated DNA filaments, which go from B to Z. I don't even know what P is. What's P DNA? Yeah. Oh, is that? Yeah. Yes. Right. I didn't have a good picture of P DNA. I just had a picture of Z. So yeah, no, the sequence is an interesting question. So now I'll go back to, again, to Chris's notation that he introduced last week. If this is the filament, I'm going to imagine I have an orthonormal triad at a certain position, arc length position. E3, by convention, is just the tangent to that center line. Of course, at a different point, the tangent's pointing in a different direction, and so is the other ones. E1 is pointing to some painted stripe, the material stripe, you could say, which is on the surface of that tube, and then E2 is just chosen to be perpendicular to both of those. There's a arc length kinematics, which is simply understood as asking what's the rate of change of these unit vectors as I go from one position to another position. So that's the derivative of one of those with respect to arc length, and that's given just by a strain vector crossed into these unit vectors. So you could think of this just as a cross product or as the anti-symmetric tensor, which it is. So I've encoded then in these strain vectors all the material properties of the filament, so I can write down the energetics just with those components. And so, as Chris explained, I can write down kappa squared, the curvature squared, as the quadratic form in the omega 1 and omega 2 components of the strain vector with some bending modulus there. The twist then is just omega 3. That's the rotation around E3. And it has its own material constant, of course. And then there's a Lagrange multiplier to ensure inextensibility of the whole filament. This is not a good energy functional for a helix, however. Why? Because the minimizer of this would want to zero omega 1, omega 2, omega 3. And we know a helix has a curvature and has a twist. So what's the correct elastic energy functional for a helical filament? That's what I'll get to in a second. Before I do that, I'll just talk about the kind of Aristotelian dynamics that you can do once you have one of these free energy functionals. So what I want to do is take variational derivatives of this functional with respect to space to get force, but because I'm at extremely low Reynolds number, I'm not going to have two derivatives of r here with respect to time, but just one. Basically, force is proportional to velocity with a drag coefficient. The same for torque. I'll have a derivative of angle. This is the rotation angle that Chris introduced in his talk, and that will be proportional to a variational derivative with respect to angle, but I've left out a couple steps here. After you reduce the equations, you find that, in fact, you can set it equal to the derivative of omega 3, which now I've just written as omega. I have to apologize for this notation, but people write omega 3 often as just omega, and so I'm going to follow that just for the twist. So this is the derivative of twist with respect to arc length. All right, so once you have a free energy functional, you can go to town with this prescription for getting the dynamics. But as I said, that wasn't a good one for a helix. So what could I use for a helix? This will do. I could have a preferred value of omega 1 and omega 2. Basically, that's saying I have a preferred value for curvature. It doesn't actually matter if I zero this one and keep this one finite, or I have some combination. You have a freedom there. But that would ensure that you have a preferred value of curvature. You could do the same for twist. But I still have quadratic expressions for these components in that case. So that would describe a helix, fine, but it wouldn't describe a filament which wants to be two different kinds of helices.
I think the helix problem is old, you know, it goes back to, I think, even Kelvin, with springs and things like that. Did he write down an energy like that, or did he have something more complicated?
I'd say it was equivalent. I don't know the paper by Kelvin. If you look in Love, you can find all of this, but done in that kind of 19th century style. This is not an original remark, I don't believe.
There were complications when you got away from straightness and expansion or something like that.
I haven't mentioned, of course, that this, in general, the free energy could have other terms, cross terms, and other things. So you could think of this as a first order.
What's the problem? Apart from the first being just quadratic, what's the problem with this? What you mentioned, it cannot describe a helix.
No, this can describe a helix. It can't describe a helix which wants to be in some cases left-handed and other cases right-handed. The reason is that the twist here just wants to be one value, right? Just wants to be omega 3 naught. That's what would minimize this. An opposite-handed helix would have the other sign. So one way to get around this is to do Landau's trick. And it really is just Landau's trick. Generalize this parabola to a quartic, because then you could have a minima at positive twist and a minima at negative twist. And the helix would be happy, I mean, the filament, I should say, would be happy as a helix in this state or as a helix in the other handedness. If you do that, then you have to do, then you have to follow Landau and introduce a penalty for flipping instantaneously from one handedness to the other. And so here's the energy cost for that. It's a gradient of the twist. And so there would be a twist gradient constant you'd introduce there. Of course, it has to be positive because you're, I just write it lambda squared because it has to be positive. But so if you do that, if you generalize a simple parabola for the twist term to a quartic, you also have to introduce this Landau term. Then if you plug in, go back to the prescription that I gave you at the bottom of the last transparency, which was the taking the variational derivatives and making them proportional to first order time derivatives, you can get a twist dynamics. And the form it takes, I've dropped the more complicated pieces, but the form it takes is this. First derivative in twist is proportional to a second derivative in the variational derivative of that quartic plus the twist gradient term with respect to the twist. So you can see, if I were to use the elastic energy for twist that I had for the straight rod, which was just a parabola, then I would get something linear in twist inside here. And so my whole equation would look like first derivative in time proportional to second derivative in space or arc length. And so that's diffusive. So the for a rod, the twist equation, the dynamical equation, is just basically diffusion with some topological or other terms that I won't go into, but what do I have here? I now have a quartic plus this twist gradient, so I'll get something which is cubic at highest order, and then the variational derivative of that, which is, will be a second derivative, like a Laplacian, so I'll have something which looks Kahn-Hilliard-like. So inside here now, for this energy functional, I'll have a second derivative with respect to arc length plus something which is highest order cubic and twist. Could be quadratic, linear, and so on. All right. Excuse me?
Psi naught describes the rest
of the field. I'm not going to talk about psi naught, but that's the that was what Chris introduced last time, is the Hashimoto. Or the natural frame, which you can define in terms of the material frame. Psi naught would then be that rest solution, yeah, the Hashimoto solution. But I'm not going to go into that. It's too involved. So I have an equation like this. What if I just look for static solutions? If I look for static solutions, yes? I have to explain that. I guess it's somewhat similar to the reason it's in the Kahn-Hilliard also. The basic idea is that there's a first order derivative in the arc length, which is comes from the previous transparency, which is the way I set it up. But then you get another derivative in arc length because basically you're looking at the moment density. So there's a lot involved in this concatenation of two derivatives here, but
if you're saying actually that omega 3 is a conserved variable in some sense, it's a Laplacian.
No. Why?
When you write like that, you usually do that for a constant.
Oh, I see what you're saying. This is not. It's not. This is not Kahn-Hilliard. Okay, this extra piece is here, which I didn't put in, which will destroy that.
I have a question there.
Yeah.
The junction between these two, known experimentally how the junctions are between the two different states, is that that can be on a microscopic scale?
Yeah, can I get back to that? I'm going to treat that in a second. Front solution. So I'm going to talk about the static solutions of that. You can ignore the psi because I'm not going to introduce the Hashimoto formalism. But one of the solutions of that is just the tanh. If I set the left-hand side of that previous equation equal to 0. So that's a natural solution. What this means is asymptotically, I'd have one-handed helix, and then a transition zone, like you're saying, of some width to the other state. So negative twist to positive twist. This is just a very symmetric solution. And C, for instance, would be the width of that, half width of that solution. Okay. So that's what the twist looks like. What does that look like in three-dimensional space? So to first order, I can say what that is, or to zeroth order. Imagine that I had my two helices that describe those asymptotic states. So here's one helix far off here, and here's the other helix. And they have to be matched somehow. So one is right-handed and the other is left-handed, right-handed, left-handed, let's say. So these represent the two sides of that tanh. Well, I can describe each helix as a curve on a cylinder. And so then, in that case, there's a natural unit cell, you might say. I cut the cylinder down a seam in the back, and I flatten it out on the table. And then the helix itself just becomes a diagonal line in each of those unit cells. So what are the sides of the unit cell? One side is pitch. That's the distance between the two curves. And the other side is the circumference of the unfolded cylinder. So that's 2 pi r. All right, so far so good. Simple enough. So I just introduce a bit of notation, something called the pitch angle. The pitch angle is just the angle that the helix, or the diagonal now, in the unit cell, makes with the pitch axis. That is the vertical axis of the helix. So if the helix is right-handed, like here, then that angle is positive. If the helix is left-handed, that angle is negative. Okay? So trigonometry can relate the diameter of the cylinder and the pitch to that angle. Very simple. So now you think back to that old classic problem of when you were a kid. In the puzzle books, the spider and the fly on the surface of the cube. How does the spider get to the fly in the most efficient way? I don't know if people had that puzzle book I had. Anyway, all right, you didn't. Okay. I thought this was universal knowledge. All right, so you have a spider and a fly on the cube. And so how does the spider get to the fly in the best way? So the trick is you flatten the cube, and you draw a straight line. You draw the geodesic in the flattened cube, and so it's the same trick you use here. So I flattened each of the asymptotic helices into this unit cell and to this unit cell. And so now how do I connect the two? So here's one helix, here's the other helix, and I have to join them somehow. How do I join them? Well, I require that the tangent is continuous of the curve. Well, the tangent is just the line which is the diagonal. It's along the diagonal of that unit cell. So that has to just go continuously across to the diagonal of the other unit cell in a straight line. The only reason I can do that is because I also assume the normals are continuous, and so I can flatten the whole thing locally at that junction, right? So I didn't say that here, but I didn't put that on the diagram. But there's a normal here too, which is allowing me to do this in the plane. So well, now I can read off the answer, because remember the pitch angles were the angle between the helix and the pitch axis. This is the pitch axis of one, and this is the pitch axis of the other. And so this angle plus this angle plus the angle between the two pitch axes has to equal 180 degrees. So that's what I've written in the box. But now I can take Hotani's data. The angles he got from the observed cylindrical radii and pitch, that's all that was required to get those angles, and plug them into this, and what I get is 109 degrees roughly, okay, between curly and normal states. So I'm off. He measured 113, and I'm getting 109. So what's the discrepancy due to? You could say the theory's wrong, but someone already said the solution here. At least I believe, that I assumed an instantaneous jump between one helix and the other helix, and no transition region, like you were saying. If you are a little more careful, you can write down the expression for the cosine of that angle as an integral expression of some functions. Now, it has to involve the curvature and the twist function of the that tanh solution, if you like. If I'm going to do this for that static solution, I could plug in the tanh here. This is what I got as an analytic expression. But in fact, I haven't been able to do this analytically. So if anyone can do this, I'd be happy. I did a perturbation expansion on it and found that the zeroth order term is exactly what the geometric argument gave, that 108.9 degrees. The second order term is quadratic in the width of the transition region, the width of that tanh, if you like. And numerically, it seems that it goes like pi times the product of curvature and twist. So that means that there's a natural transition region scale, which is 1 over the square root of curvature times twist. I think you can argue that from a more simple point of view than doing all of this. But I haven't made that argument yet. So if anyone has a version of that, I'd like to see it. So now I can fit that missing 4 degrees. If I assume it's all due to this extra term, then I can say, that extra 4 degrees is just due to the C. And if you do that, you can get a rough idea of C from the data. And so it's of order 80-100 nanometers, in some cases less, because you can't really see the discrepancy between this formula and the angle and some other transitions. So that's a way to get a handle on that transition region. All right, I don't know how much time I have.
These things are actually stuck on the surface as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one could imagine there's a systematic error.
These two states, the curly and normal, are seen not just in those experiments. So the data for the pitch and the radius I could get other ways. But you're right, the angle, the best way to do the angle is when it's near the glass surface. Oh. All right. So just to summarize, okay, so what I presented so far has been fairly toy model, very simple toy model without much realistic detail. Quartic twist potential gives rise to, at least statically, a kink in the three-dimensional shape, and a twist that looks like this is a function of arc length. You might ask, what are the dynamical solutions, since that was just done statically? I'll build on earlier work, which basically divided the dynamical solutions into two classes, and we gave them trendy names, crankshafting and speedometer cabling. Crankshafting, so when I convert from one state to another, I'm basically converting twist to rotation. So you might ask, how can that rotation come about? So one way is if the other helical segment, if its helical axis bodily rotates around the other helical axis. So we call that crankshafting because it looks like a crank. Alternatively, I could imagine that those directions that the helical axes make in space are actually fixed, fixed as directions. And so each so that the twist that's converted into rotation is actually just rotating around those axes which are fixed in direction space. You can appreciate that in terms of the power dissipated in a viscous fluid, these two will behave very differently. Because in this case, I'm actually rotating an entire helix like this as an object through the fluid. And in this case, I'm just rotating around a helical axis. And in fact, that's the case. If you look at the power dissipated as a function of the geometric parameters, this is for crankshafting, you get something, if L is the length of one of these helical segments, and I should point out, in the dynamical case, this is a front moving along the filament, so this L is actually changing with time. But let's just imagine that at any given time, I'm just looking at it, so it has a well-defined length. Then the power goes like L cubed in this case. However, in this case, it's just linear in the length. So there's a dramatic difference in that length. And that actually should show up in terms of the biological applications. As you said, if you look at that Hotani image, you'll see near the end, it's actually going out of the streamline of the flow. And you're beginning to see this block angle that Hotani measured. So there can be transitions between those two motions where you do crankshafting relative to speedometer cabling. Okay, so I to finish up, since I don't think I have much time, I'll do a back of the envelope calculation of the front speed just using that previous idea. So this is for Hotani's experiment. In Hotani's experiment, the filaments were basically aligned. So I'll use the speedometer cabling power dissipated, and I'll equate that with the power that you're getting from going from one helical state to the other helical state. And so that's got to involve the quartic potential that I introduced. And so delta V is the difference in the states in the energies between those two minima when you go from one minimum to the other. And C is the front speed velocity. So if you do the units, you'll see this works out nicely. This has units of power. So this is what would be generated by a flip, and this is what would be lost due to the fluid. Plugging in, I won't go into all these numbers, but here's a little table in CGS units of the numbers that correspond to Hotani's experiment. Delta T is the torque difference as computed from the Hotani's data. Zeta is a drag coefficient for methyl cellulose in the concentrations he was using. R, this is, okay, so here's a test. This is the radius of that cylinder. So if it really is 0.2 microns, I should have 2 times 10 to the fifth minus 5 in CGS. So that seems to work. So the diameter of that helix is 0.4 microns. That's right. And the length roughly corresponds to 10 microns. Anyway, plug those numbers in. You get a front speed solving this equation, which is roughly 5 microns per second. And that's right in the range that Hotani measured for the movement of those fronts, which was of order 4 to 7 microns per second. So this part at least coheres. I'm going to finish up. Before I
sorry, what rate is going to be rotated here? What was the typical rate for
the... Sorry. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Okay, I've got to multiply 5 times 10 to the minus 4 times 4 times 10 to the 4. So I get 20 in CGS for this per second, right?
This was being, the rotation was driven by the flow.
20 hertz. This is not with a motor. There's no motor here at all in Hatani's experiment. This is just rotation driven by the flow. It's not terribly far off from the 100 hertz you'd expect from.
The front is propagating much faster than the apparent motion just due to rotation.
Yeah.
If you just track a spot, you know. I know. You know, just by eye, it looks like you have a front moving just because.
Oh, because of the screw motion.
And this
yeah.
is a faster motion than that, but substantially.
I can't get a. I can't.
No, but it's not.
Okay. Yeah. So let me finish up with my movie.
Actually, quick question.
Yeah.
The speed depends on the length of the crankshaft and segment.
Yes.
Does that work? Does it speed up as the crankshaft and segment gets shorter?
We haven't looked at that. That's a good thing to test. I'll show you the images, and whether you can extract that is not. It's not clear because you don't see it. You don't really see the crankshafting. This is. This was all assuming speedometer cabling, and so that's the straightened out by flow case. There is crankshafting at the end, and I could redo this for crankshafting, but then I'd have a different dependence on L. There'd still be a dependence on L, like you're saying, but it'd be cubed in that case. Okay, the narration's in Japanese. I got this tape from Hatani last week. So here is a rotation due to the flow. It's attached here. This segment doesn't rotate. That you can understand, actually. It's always the next segment or segments that rotate. There's a better image coming up, I think. So you see Hatani's, one of his problems with this experiment is that he has to find a filament that's attached in just the best way, because many of these are just stuck to the glass slide all over the place, and they don't move at all. So he's changing the direction of flow in that case. There's a really beautiful one I want to. Oh, yeah, there's the bend, yeah. Here you see the angle he discovered. No, in this case, it's not. It only moves above a critical rate of flow. Here's a beautiful transition from normal to curly. Oops, went out of focus. Here it is, normal, curly. No. I've gone too far. I'm trying to cue the tape up. That's the one I want. All right, there we go. All right, here's a beautiful example, but. Yeah, I don't see the transition there. Oops. We lost that one. All right, here we go. I don't know, maybe this is the one we saw before. I think it is. All right, I can't find the very good sequence. I'm sorry.
What's the joint between moving and non moving?
How does that avoid getting torqued to pieces?
Yeah, so this.
They're both normal segments.
They both did look normal in that case. So that one I don't understand actually. Then. When you see curly and normal, they're very distinct. They have different pitches and. Up here? You mean here?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
Go a half period from the top, and it looks like there's another one there.
Oh, up there.
Yeah, that seems to be a point.
Perhaps. Uh-oh. All right, there we go. All right, well, I think. There we go. Oh, look at this. You see that? That was. There it goes curly. And then it. Right off the edge.
Does your velocity, does your speed depend on your free parameter, your psi?
Psi?
Yeah.
No, not by that argument, no.
Is this tape, are you psi? Is it just going from one to the other?
Ah, here it is. This is the one I wanted to show you. All right. Oh, that's horrible.
So the front is moving faster than the parent
Yes, that's possible. Yeah. That's
possible. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll end on that.
Just to clarify how much of this you do understand, that it's,
yeah,
there's nucleation, there's a rate of propagation. How much are you able to get in?
So there, the only model we've been able to solve is the toy one. There's some other things we'd like to do. We'd like models with to be able to solve the asymmetric potentials, and we'd like to solve things with different. Again, the solutions I showed you were with the were perfectly symmetric, opposite twists, same helical radius and things like that. So we'd like to plug in more of the exact parameters for the biological situation. In terms of the dynamics, the full equations we have trouble solving. So what we do is we assume a situation which is similar to the experiments where things are aligned with the flow. And so there's very small deviations from that center, from that line, the streamline. So then we have some numerical simulations which can capture this dynamics. I didn't show those. And they don't show periodic phenomena. They show more episodic flipping, which is roughly. So what comes out of those simulations are parameters which are roughly in line with the experiments. Not exactly, though. So we'd like to understand if there's an important discrepancy there. The next important thing to do is consider driven systems, driven by the motor, not just by the flow. And then we'd like to understand interactions between flagella. So the hydrodynamic interactions between neighboring flagella. So there, it gets more complicated if you. All right, so there's a lot to do. Okay?
Thanks very much.
Sure.